this case, which is case number 57269, Victor Milan Rodriguez versus State. This is a case that will be interested to the students because the defendant was a student himself, a young person, a juvenile at the time of all this. We have Todd Clinton for the appellant, Mr. Milan Rodriguez, and Chad Thompson, the district attorney for the respondent, the State of Nevada. And Todd, if you could just turn around and tell the students a little bit about the case, then you won't have to argue the facts to us.
Very good.
And then we'll have Chad Thompson talk a little bit about the facts.
Your Honors, good morning. Todd Plunkett with Lockner Ballinger and Plunkett on 11th Avenue.
You can turn around. That's my
stretch. How many of you are older than 15? If you're 17 or 18, imagine spending the last 4 years of your life in state prison, because that's where my client is. His name is Mr. Milan Rodriguez, and he's the appellant in this case. And at the age of 15, he got arrested for basically heisting cars. And he was at NYTC, and him and another person were accused and charged with battering a correction officer. And they really hurt him. And he's permanently injured, and it's a tragedy. And my 15-year-old client was involved in that. And as a result of his conviction, he's going to spend almost 10 years of his life in a state prison. He was 15. He could barely read English. And he had an eighth-grade education. So if you don't think school is important, think about my client's story.
Thank you, Todd.
All right.
District Attorney, yes.
You bet.
Just a couple other things. He was initially, he and his co-defendant were initially charged with attempted murder. What they did is they hit him with a 5-pound metal weight that was inside of a pillowcase. The co-defendant used that particular instrument, and there is some evidence that you'll hear about where Milan Rodriguez had a pipe. This particular proceeding is what's called a writ. It's a form of appeal. What happened was we charged him with attempted murder, and then he entered into a plea bargain where he pled to lesser charges than attempted murder. And he has now filed, this isn't a direct appeal, this is called a writ, and what he's charging here, or what his allegations are, is that the counsel that he had at the time that he entered his plea didn't do his job right, or he wasn't effectively represented by counsel at the time he entered his plea. So this is a little bit different, but it's a form of appeal. If you think of it in that way, I think you'll understand it better. But it is all about whether or not Mr. Cochran, who was his attorney when he entered his plea, did his job correctly.
Okay, so we'll make sure that the attorney who's arguing on behalf of the defendant in this matter was not the attorney who had his client plead guilty. This is an attorney who's actually challenging what the other attorney did, that he was ineffective. So we're ready to proceed. You have 15 minutes. Each side gets 15 minutes, by the way.
Your Honor, it's an honor to be before you. I'm probably more intimidated by the audience behind me than I am the one in front of me. So with that in mind, there's four issues before you. One is, was Mr. Cochran effective when he did not withdraw his guilty plea? Number two, was Mr. Cochran ineffective when he didn't file a direct appeal? Number three, was Mr. Cochran ineffective when he didn't present any mitigating evidence at the time of his sentencing? And then number four, was Mr. Cochran ineffective, or maybe was there judicial error in the canvassing during the plea agreement at the time of the sentencing? As we all know, the standard of review here by this court is set forth in Strickland and its progeny. I'm not going to belabor that point. I know this court is intimately familiar with that series of cases. What I am going to talk about, however, are the facts, the timeline, and those things that I think are relevant for consideration by the Supreme Court in allowing a remand back and possibly a new trial. The first one in some detail is trial counsel was ineffective for failing to file a motion to withdraw appellant's guilty plea. Now, we all know under 176, before the sentencing, if you enter a plea agreement, as a general rule, you can withdraw it. And when the standard of review by the district court at that time is, are there grounds for it? Does it serve the ends of justice? What's appropriate for the ends of justice? And in this case, when we look at the facts of this case, there was ample reason for withdrawing the plea agreement. Now, what is significant about that? I want you to understand the situation which we're confronted with. We're not dealing with an adult. We're dealing with a 15-year-old boy who could barely read English, had an eighth grade education, and as Mr. Cochran admitted to, and it's in the record, they are much more difficult to deal with than having an adult client. And, so, and this is really his first run-in with the law. So I think that there's a higher review. I would suggest to this court that when we have these juvenile adolescent clients, I think an attorney that takes those kind of cases needs to understand that that's his client and that they have an extra duty to pay attention to that. And I think that that's important to consider in a case such as this. Now, in the case of him, what we find is that you had both Mr. Hudson and Mr. Milan Rodriguez take the plea agreement, do the preliminary hearing at the same time. So Mr. Cochran is in the preliminary hearing. Here's all the evidence. At least three of the five witnesses from the state also that Mr. Hudson's the one that delivered the blow. All right? The witness, we'll talk about him here in a minute, Mr. Gormley, basically says that he's the one that did it. Okay, that Mr. Hudson was the one that did it. He was the witness at the red hearing. Now, when Mr. Hudson enters the plea agreement admitting the Class B felony and that he was the batterer of the staff member, Mr. Cochran had a chance to withdraw his plea agreement. Because now what you're confronted with is you have the non-batterer young man, and you take it in light of these facts, Your Honors.
But Mr. Plimpton, did the evidence establish that Mr. Milan Rodriguez knew that Mr. Hudson was going to batter this officer? Or how the record?
Well, the evidence at the preliminary hearing, there was no evidence on that regard. And what is interesting, at the time that Mr. Hudson struck the victim in this case, my client, Mr. Milan Rodriguez, actually stopped and rendered aid, and prior to that, actually told Mr. Hudson to stop hitting the guy. So he comes off comes off the bunk, and in the admission plea, we'll talk about this in point number four, comes off the bunk, Mr. Hudson hits the victim, then my client intercedes with the battery, and then renders aid, and at some point in the testimony, Mr. Hudson turns to Mr. Milano Rodriguez and goes, "Boy, are you going to leave or not? Are you going with me or not?" Or something to that effect. And that's when this 15-year-old boy steps up and heads out the door with Mr. Hudson.
I understand. I just want to make one point to the students. Sorry,
yes,
to take some of your time.
Okay.
And we have a situation here. If Mr. Milan Rodriguez and Mr. Hudson plan to escape and plan to hit the officer and all like that, even if Mr. Milan Rodriguez didn't actually hit the officer, there's an argument that he'd be liable for what Mr. Hudson did. Like if two people go into a grocery store, maybe they're going to rob the store and they don't plan to hurt anybody, but one of the two robbers shoots somebody at the store and kills them, the other person that goes in with the robbery is responsible for murder, even though they didn't pull the trigger on the gun. So that's the issues that I was concerned about, what right. Mr. Milan Rodriguez and Mr. Hudson had planned and what they were doing together.
Right. And there is a dispute of facts on that. Remember, we never went to trial on this case. Preliminary hearing, two plea agreements, and that's where we found ourselves. Now,
let me pause you for a moment, though. The district court judge in this case, Judge Mameo, made a very long written decision, 20-some-odd pages, and in it he addressed the very point you're just making to us, which is Mr. Hudson changed his testimony to accept full responsibility for this assault. He notes the fact that your client actually took responsibility when he talked to the court, and there were a number of other witnesses who likewise said your client did play a role in this. And based on that, the totality of the circumstances, Judge Mameo found there was no basis to conclude ineffective assistance in not filing a motion to withdraw the plea.
Mm-hmm.
Why should we second-guess what Judge Mameo found? We're here to correct an error, and
right.
What error did Judge Mameo make?
Well, I think it's a couple-fold. I want to kind of get at both questions, if I may, Your Honor. Count 11 was conspiracy to commit a battery. It's a gross misdemeanor. So when you look at the Strickland standard, if we don't withdraw this plea agreement, there's your prejudice. Because what he pled guilty to is a level B felony, which not only is a B felony, but now it gets stacked. It's consecutive, not concurrent. Whereas if you get the gross misdemeanor versus the B felony for the escape, you can probably run them concurrent. At least that's my understanding of the law. Now, Your Honor, here's your question to this. I'm going to get at what occurred not only at the change of plea hearing, but also at the sentencing. And there's several pages in the record that actually evidence Judge Mameo's own confusion as to the difficulty of eliciting a plea for Mr. Milan Rodriguez. Because when you look at the record, the specific question was asked, did you batter the victim? The answer, no. The change of plea hearing stopped at that point, and that's when Judge Mameo, in the change of plea, spent several pages trying to make the plea fit the facts that he was pleading to. I'm going to talk about that in some detail when we can get to it. But let me kind of finish my point on the first one. This is why this is significant for you. When you start talking about the first time under Strickland, any reasonable attorney would have, the minute that Hudson changed his testimony and took responsibility, Your Honor, for the battery, why would you plead your 15-year-old client that didn't strike this gentleman to the same battery that someone else took responsibility for? Especially when the state has count 11, which I think is the appropriate count, which is conspiracy to commit battery. It's a lesser-included offense. To me, as an attorney appointed to play Monday morning quarterback, and that's a tough position to be in, but that's what I'm asked to do, that's how I viewed that situation. And I think it's something we can really hang our hat on here. That's exactly what should have occurred. But let me move on to point number two.
Well,
at the time I have remaining.
Your client stated to the court in answer to its questions, so we figured I would cut and run, but without anyone knowing. I decided to strike Mr. Conroy, the victim, while Anthony went behind him. And then it goes on that your client admitted that he was distracting the officer so that his co-defendant could commit this assault. The judge concludes there's a factual basis for the plea. Right. I'm having trouble finding an error by Judge Mameo in standing by that conclusion.
Well, without arguing with you, Your Honor, when you go back and you look at the writ hearing, and it's actually on page, I draw the court's attention, it's 129-189 in appellant's appendices, pages 153 through 156, there are four pages where Judge Mameo, during the writ hearing, basically stopped the process and was trying to understand for himself exactly how he walked through the change of plea. And at the end, I think he comes to the same conclusion that you do, but as an advocate, and my point on behalf of my client, is that how do you get a battery out of that plea? How do you get a battery out of it? He admitted to getting off the bunk and distracting the guy. That's the extent of it. Okay? Now, he might be a co-conspirator. I think there's a more appropriate charge, and I think any defense attorney would have, that's the direction that we should have gone here, and that's why...
I understand your argument on
right.
That.
Right. Okay. Now, to get on with point number two, and I know this court's very familiar with this argument. There was no direct appeal in this case. Our argument simply is this, and that is, he wasn't properly canvassed. Again, you have to take Mr. Milan Rodriguez for who he is, a 15-year-old boy who can barely read English, has an eighth-grade education. I think there's heightened scrutiny here on the attorney to make sure that 15-year-old citizen understands exactly what it is he's signing. And there's all kinds of anecdotal evidence throughout the hearings in this. His answer for no on the battery. the fact that that Judge Mamet, not only during the change of plea, but also at the time of sentencing, has to re-explain exactly what's going on here. It is clear from the record that this young man did not know what was happening. Now,
Did Mr. Milan Rodriguez, was he fluent in English and all?
He could speak English, Your Honor. And I've met him several times, and he says he can do that. And at the time, there was testimony at the time of the offense, he could speak English. But it's the reading of English, understanding the written plea agreement. You know, you have to be very meticulous about that, especially when you're confronted with a client like that. Now, what I would tell you about, as we move on from point, the second issue, that's before this court to the third issue, ineffective for him to present mitigating evidence. I would just simply say this. I think our pleading argues the point very well. There was none. There was no effort by trial counsel to find any mitigating evidence. The standard of review here and the progeny of cases I could find is that there's a threshold where you have to put the best foot forward for your client. There were no phone calls to the family. There was no background check. They didn't hire a private investigator. They did nothing. Mr. Cochran, at that point, relied upon the PSI to make his argument. And you're confronted with two Class B felonies, and you're going in a sentencing like that, and you're looking at a stack of two concurrents. You need to do something for your client.
When you mentioned PSI, you're referring to a pre-sentence investigation report.
Yes, sir.
Prepared by Division of Parole and Probation that
kind
of summarizes the defendant's history and criminal background and all.
And I will keep a focus on what my total audience is here. You have a pre-sentence report, Your Honor. And so, and essentially that's the argument. So, no appeal, no direct appeal, none, no counseling, no mitigating efforts to sentencing. And let's actually go to point number four, which is the proper canvas.
Well, let me talk about the mitigating circumstances.
Yes, sir.
It seems like, at least my reading of the record, is that his family was unavailable, that Cochran did try to call the family, but they lived at the other end of the state. And also, he was able to orally describe to Judge Mamet the fact that this juvenile's parents were gambling addicts who were not very involved in his life, and his having to work from the age of nine to his teenage years, and he became involved in gangs at the age of 14, thinking a gang could provide protection for his younger brother. So that sounds like at least some mitigation that Judge Mamet could have taken into account. So I don't think you can say no mitigation, and I know as a defense attorney, sometimes you can't get mitigation live witnesses to come in. I mean, it makes it tough, especially if they're socially poorer than the average person.
If I may, Your Honor, I take some issue with the recitation by the state on those facts and in the way that Judge Mamet viewed them, because I understood from the testimony of my client at the writ hearing that his mother was available to testify, all right? And this young man, some of the operative facts that I really thought were important was the only person to render assistance to the victim was my client. None of the other students did. No one else in that building did. And so, why not bring in the other defendant as a mitigating witness? Why not bring him in and say, Your Honor, I'm sorry for it that it happened. I'm the primary guy that did. This 15-year-old kid, I'm the one that led him into this really bad situation. I mean, there just wasn't any effort to do any of that. And did not even make an attempt to hire a PI, the public defender's office, to hire a PI in Vegas to locate the mom, to bring her to the sentencing hearing, to at least have mom sitting in the background. I mean, that's, to me, the lack of effort here is compelling to me as the attorney.
Thank you very much for your
Thank
presentation.
Thank you, Your
Honor. For the state of Nevada.
Your Honors, may it please the Court. With regards to what Mr. Plimpton has articulated as the facts with regards to Mr. Milan Rodriguez's role in there, the State would point out that that is largely from the testimony of Milan Rodriguez and Mr. Hudson at the writ hearing. It is not consistent with the testimony that was given at the preliminary hearing, nor was it consistent with Mr. Gravely's testimony that was at the writ hearing, nor was it consistent with what Mr. Milan Rodriguez told Mr. Cochran had occurred in this particular instance. The other thing I want to point out is that Mr. Milan Rodriguez pled to a principle to battery by a prisoner in lawful custody with the use of a deadly weapon. He did not plead to a battery. He pled as the principal. Therefore, he was unlawfully engaged in this with Mr. Hudson. And therefore, the proof was, what were they doing together? And there was ample evidence that from the preliminary hearing, where you have witnesses who said the night before they saw Hudson and Milan Rodriguez together saying, we're going to run tonight. We're going to run. And they were making some sign indicating that their time was up, that it was time for them to go. Mr. Gravely testified at the writ hearing that he, the night before the incident, was approached by Milan Rodriguez and Mr. Hudson and engaged in this, asked if he wanted to join it. He was told, we've got to wait, we're going to hit the night man, and we're going to run. And Mr. Gravely initially told him, yeah, I'll go ahead and go along with that. And then as he thought about it more, he said, you guys are probably going to kill him. He told this to Milan Rodriguez and Hudson. He said, you're probably going to kill him. That's stupid. I'm not going with you. Mr. Gravely backed out, wisely so. Milan Rodriguez, in reply to that, Milan Rodriguez is the one who told Mr. Gravely, I'm going to hit him with the 5-pound weight. And when Mr. Gravely said, you guys are stupid, you're going to kill him, Milan Rodriguez said, I don't care. And if you look at his statements to his attorney, as well as at the pre-sentence investigation report, he wrote a statement saying, I helped in the assault on the staff. To Mr. Cochran, he divulged that not only was he involved in this and knew of the plan to hit Mr. Conroy with the 5-pound weight in the pillowcase, he himself hit Mr. Conroy with a pipe. And Mr. Cochran testified that he was aware of witnesses that had seen Mr. Milan Rodriguez do this. Now, the reason then, and Mr. Cochran explains, and this can give some explanation as to what occurred at the sentencing hearing, or at the change of plea hearing. Mr. Cochran explains that because none of that testimony came out at the preliminary hearing, their theory was, because Mr. Milan Rodriguez was remorseful and wanted to take responsibility for this, their theory was if he pled to the principal to battery, that hopefully the court would then push the blame onto Mr. Hudson and he might get a lesser sentence. That was their theory, and they wanted to keep that particular information out, the pipe. And in going back to the preliminary hearing transcript, you have the testimony from Sergeant Otterstrom, who went to the hospital to see Mr. Conroy, who was terribly injured. And he describes two types of injuries on Mr. Conroy. He talks about lacerations on the back of his head, and all of the witnesses say they saw Hudson hitting him with the pillowcase and the lead weight on the back of his head, a weight having an edge on it that would create lacerations. And then he said that on his left side, there was a contusion, a big contusion on there, consistent with a flatter object like a pipe, consistent with what Mr. Cochran said Milan Rodriguez told him.
Let me ask you this question. Counsel for the appellant talked about that there was a count in the information that was filed against his client of conspiracy to commit battery with a deadly weapon. And that's a gross misdemeanor, which is up to a year in the county jail rather than a felony where you have to go to prison. Now, if you're guilty of a conspiracy, you also can be found guilty of the substantive crime of battery. Isn't that correct?
Yes.
And so how do you view that? In other words, would he have only been found guilty of conspiracy?
With regards to the principal and the conspiracy?
Yes.
Typically, I believe the state has a right to request that the higher charges are heard from the jury first, and they can make a decision, and he can be found guilty on both of those. It'll be more of a sentencing issue, I believe, at that point.
Well, in this particular case, the thing Mr. Plimpton alluded to the students at the beginning, and Mr. Milan Rodriguez got a sentence of 20 years in prison where he's not eligible for parole until 8 years of serving at least 8 years of his sentence. Doesn't mean he gets parole, but so he was 15, so potentially he could be up to 35 years old before he can get out of prison then. So it's a pretty tough sentence and all. I know it's a serious offense and all, but I can understand the concern of taking a close look at this and what happened, you know, how the attorney handled it. Mm-hmm.
There is also the consideration that conspiracy only requires the agreement between the two, and a principal actually requires an act by the aider and abettor, and he has to have done something. And here we have Milan Rodriguez, testimony of him trying to recruit other people, that he is actively talking about, I'm going to be the one who hits him. At some point, they do actually follow through with this plan. They change their minds, and it sounds like Hudson is the one with the pillowcase at that point. Milan Rodriguez then acquires the bar, as was learned by Mr. Cochran later. So, and then you also have the testimony of Milan Rodriguez getting the walkie-talkies by the other folks. This is all part of the plan of their escape. He also, there was testimony of him dismantling the phone, although there was some conflicting testimony as to who was the one that actually did that. You have Mr. Hudson and Mr. Milan Rodriguez during the crime. Hudson says to Milan Rodriguez, hurry up. Milan Rodriguez says to Hudson, let's go. So clearly they're in consort and encouraging one another in getting dressed, getting the items that they wanted, and then they left together, which is completely contradictory to what they testified to at the writ hearing. And this was the first time this had ever come up.
What about the obligation, though, of Cochran to file a motion to withdraw the plea? What about his obligation under Strickland?
Well,
Strickland is a case that talks about ineffective assistance of counsel, and not only is it you have to be below the standard, what would be the standard of our practicing law, but also there has to be prejudice. I can see the prejudice, but I don't see the first prong of this.
Well, with regards to that, there has to have been something other new evidence or something that he had to have relied on at that point that would have made him think that he has to withdraw this plea. At this point, sure, we had said that Mr. Hudson was the one who swung the weight and hit him. Mr. Milan Rodriguez was pleading as a principal to that particular crime. He was not pleading as the guilty person who did it, who actually swung the weight. He was pleading as a principal, as an aider and abettor. And so this was in consort with what he had heard at the preliminary hearing. As far as him talking about the full responsibility that Hudson acquired, that was the first time Hudson had ever testified with regards to anything, and all of his testimony at the writ hearing was completely inconsistent, where he says that I didn't agree with anybody. I wasn't talking about this plan with anyone. I did this all on my own, and the next thing I know, I'm running out the door, and Mr. Milan Rodriguez is following me. All of that is completely unknown by Mr. Cochran at the time this occurs. He has the testimony of all of those fellows who were there. He has Mr. Gravely and those statements from these other fellows who said, no, they were acquiring other people to join them. And in fact, Milan Rodriguez, in his own statement to one of the head staff, he says that there were three other gentlemen, or was it two? I think there were three other gentlemen besides Hudson, including Mr. Gravely, three other that they were trying to get to go with them because one of them had the wherewithal to be able to hotwire a car.
Mr. Thompson, again, as the students have heard, this case is not about whether Mr. Milan Rodriguez is guilty and all that. He's pled guilty. The issue is, did the attorney properly represent him in advising him to plead guilty and take a plea bargain? Because of that, was there any evidence in the record of Mr. Cochran's background? I mean, like he was, I think he works for Pershing County. He was like a public defender, and I know he was a Supreme Court staff criminal staff attorney. Did any of that come out, or was that... It did come out.
Yes,
so that's part of the record in the
it
case.
It is. It's in the writ hearing.
Okay. And speaking of the record, so that everybody understands, Judge Mamayo was able to look at the credibility of all the witnesses who testified, including Mr. Cochran, who testified as to what he did and why he did it. Isn't that correct?
That is correct. And he made specific findings that he did not find Mr. Milan Rodriguez credible, and he found Mr. Cochran credible with regards to the issue of whether or not to pursue the appeal. Also with regards to the other issue regarding sentencing, the one thing I wanted to bring up there was the report done that Mr. Cochran requested regarding Dr. Larson. He had a doctor, a psychologist, an independent person who prepared a report and did a forensic interview of Milan Rodriguez, and he made recommendations that Milan Rodriguez was suitable to treatment, that we could rehabilitate this guy. That was utilized at sentencing. He specifically did that for sentencing. The other thing I wanted to point out with regards to the sentencing argument, the burden at the writ hearing is on Milan Rodriguez, and he did not bring the parents to say what evidence they might have testified to.
Mr. Larson, in his report, went into depth about Milan Rodriguez's home life and his parents and all of that stuff. You had all of that, not only in Dr. Larson's report, but Mr. Cochran also presented that same argument. And so to say that he did absolutely nothing for sentencing belies the record at this point.
Well, Justice Gibbons also brought up the issue that we were dealing with a defendant who's like 15 years old and got a pretty stiff sentence. How do we view these sentences for somebody like a 15-year-old?
Well, in this particular case, because they were charged with attempted murder, it's automatic certification. There's no certification process because of the seriousness of the crime.
So even though you're a juvenile, you have to stand trial as an adult?
Yes, if you're tried for attempted murder, yes.
Yeah, I think, again, just for the students' benefit, so regardless of someone's age, if they commit murder or attempt to murder somebody, they're tried as an adult, and so it could be a 14-year-old, 15-year-old like his age, and whereas if it were a drug offense or burglary or something, they would go to juvenile court and then it's not until they're 18 that they're tried as adults. Is that how it works?
Correct. There are specific circumstances where we can either automatically certify them or we can make a motion and have a big hearing about whether or not to certify someone. But in this case, we didn't do that because of the charge.
And as long as our district judges sentence somebody within the range of the statute, this is something we don't overturn.
Yeah, that's what I was getting to, is that basically there's nothing wrong with the sentence whatsoever. Each count was punishable up to 10 years, and he did not go beyond that, and he stayed within the 40% rule, ordering 4 to 10 years on each count and running them consecutively, so there was nothing amiss in what he did with regards to the sentencing. With regards to their age, it is somewhat brought up in the Bryant case where you talk about whether or not somebody understands the charge that they're pleading to, and the judge really did both of the requirements in Bryant, where he not only had the elements and the ranges of punishment explained to him, and he said, yes, I understand those, but he also requested the factual basis. And Bryant also allows a defendant to adopt statements by either counsel or judge as his. So when the judge was asking if they're terming them as leading questions or somehow trying to make the plea fit the charge, that's perfectly permissible, and the judge has wide latitude to be able to elicit those statements to make sure there is a factual understanding. And I think that with regards to that, what you see actually when you review that, based on his statements to Mr. Cochran that he had actually struck Mr. Conroy, he's trying to avoid telling Judge Mamayo at the change of plea that, I hit him with the pipe. He was trying to stick with the principle. I helped him, I distracted him, I did something else, but he was trying to avoid actually having to tell the judge that, and I think that's what you see when Mr. Milan Rodriguez is somewhat having a hard time.
Also, I think just again for the students' benefit, we heard a case earlier this morning which involved a no contest or an Alford plea where the defendant pled guilty without admitting guilt. He just admitted there was enough evidence to convict him. This particular case was not an Alford plea. There was admissions made by Mr. Milan Rodriguez as part of the court's questioning. And all.
Yes, there's admissions. You have his admissions to Mr. Larson, who said he questioned him extensively, Dr. Larson did, and he said he knew of the plan. And he participated in it. And you had Milan Rodriguez himself stating, I helped in this. I thought the staff was keeping me there too long because I was a gangster and they just didn't like me. And he says himself, I'm not suitable for probation, which is another thing regarding the sentencing. So your client says, I'm not suitable for probation. I think I belong in prison. That puts Mr. Cochran in a tight spot right there.
Yeah, we call that felony stupid.
Are there any other questions?
No, thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes this particular hearing. This case will stand submitted. These attorneys did a fabulous job. These are very, very good attorneys. Let's give them a round of applause.